This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
All statements and opinions expressed by guests of the Adult in the Room podcast are strictly their own and do not necessarily reflect the beliefs or opinions of the host, producers, or advertisers. All interviews are presented in their most complete possible form in the interests of free speech. No statements should be interpreted as financial, legal, or medical advice. Listener and viewer discretion are strongly advised.
It's the Adult in the Room podcast with Victoria Taft. That's me.
Welcome to the Adult in the Room podcast. I'm Victoria Taft. And as I've always said, we don't waste your time here. We talk with people who are important thinkers, people who tell you the underpinnings of why you believe what you believe or what you had questions about. And Dr. Roy Spencer, of course, is right in that idea behind the show. He is a man who's been in the global warming game, if you will, for decades. He's a, I would say, a climate catastrophe skeptic. And it's so refreshing to see that a person who is skeptical about the earth is burning and we're all going to die soon, catastrophists out there, being a person who is, it's nice to know somebody like that's in academia and is normal and is in working at NASA and is normal and is a voice of reason. And the reason I say that is because, you know, for years, ever since I've been an adult, we've been told that we're all going to die soon. We were all going to starve to death. And we were going to go through a series of problems in the world. And the result being that we are going to freeze, boil. We are going to blow up. We are going to starve ourselves to death. The sun will not be able to be seen anymore. And all of these catastrophic prognostications, all to achieve what appears to be a political end. That's just me. It just feels like a political op. And so that's one of the reasons why I was so thrilled when Dr. Roy Spencer said, sure, I'll come on your podcast. Wow, that's pretty cool. And I appreciate him coming on the Adult in the Room podcast. Welcome to the Adult in the Room podcast, Dr. Spencer. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Good to be with you, Victoria. Thank you for having me.
I'm kind of dumb about this. I mean, I've been following the issue for quite some time, but the thing that I can understand the best is how politicized it has become. It is clear that this is an information op from way back, and we have to follow the narrative. And so I automatically recoil from that, and I am not someone who's easily persuaded. So it's left to people like you, the smart guys in the room, who can tell me, am I wrong or right when I say that I don't think we're in a climate catastrophe, but what do you think?
I agree with you. I don't think we're in any kind of climate catastrophe. Everything has been greatly exaggerated, and we'll get into that during this podcast. But something you said in your introduction made me remember the political roots of this. It's been over 30 years ago that John Christie and I visited the White House to visit with Bob Watson, who was sort of Al Gore's chief of staff in terms of climate issues, okay? And we sat down with Dr. Watson, and Bob Watson thought we were on his side. And remember, this is over 30 years ago. Now, he was key. He was at NASA, and he was a key proponent of reducing chlorofluorocarbons, you know, Freon, which was, you know, allegedly destroying the ozone layer, okay? He was a big part of all of that that happened back then, the Montreal Protocol to, you know, stop the production of chlorofluorocarbons and all of that. And he said something 32 years ago when we visited him. He said, Freon showed us that we could do this legislatively or you know, through government fiat. He said carbon dioxide is next. So
wow.
Even long ago, they had the goal in sight. they wanted to regulate and get rid of carbon dioxide emissions. This is when they were just forming the international panel, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, to look into the problem, to see whether there was a problem. But they already had, you know, the policy goal in mind that long ago.
Why?
Oh, well, you know as well as I do, you know, to the extent that the government is in control, the happier government employees are, right? I mean, I used to work for the government. I'm now at the university, but when I worked for NASA, you know, you're always trying to justify your job in terms of being useful somehow. But also, the only way that you can have any power in government is to have a budget. You know, you got to have money to spend. Right. Well, you know, this is sort of one of the ultimate issues that the government can spend money on and then, you know, ultimately control our lives. Right. I mean, by telling what kind of cars we can drive, what kind of stoves we can have, you know, whether we can have a barbecue going in the backyard. I mean, the possibilities are endless because energy is necessary for everything we do. And for the time being, like it or not, most of our energy is going to continue to come from fossil fuels.
People don't understand, I think, that in order to produce anything, and that means anything from being at home and cooking dinner to being a Fortune gazillion company and making widgets, you have to have energy. Energy is productivity. Productivity is survival. Survival is everything, and you can help other people survive as a result. But that seems to be out of fashion now.
Well, it does seem like that as the generations go by, the American public, and this may be true in other countries as well, you know, young Americans know less and less about how the world works. I hate to say that, but that just seems like the way it is.
Yeah. The closing of the American mind. You know, you've been censored by Google. You have been mocked. Here's one such example of a reporter, and this is what you used to have to put up with. Maybe you still do. Obviously, you're right, and so many others are wrong. But here is an excerpt from an interview you did on the Piers Morgan show many years ago.
I remember this. They dragged me out of bed to do this.
Wow. They dragged you out of bed to be insulted by a guy who knows less than you. Wow. That's amazing. Well, I want everyone to hear and see this excerpt of this interview because it tells you everything.
If you've revised your position, I'd love to hear about it.
Well, you're wrong about that. Talk about climate change. We don't know. I don't believe that
man-made climate change. You reject the 99%. So you stand against the 97% of scientists who say this. And Pierce, I have to tell you, as a journalist, you know, we don't talk to tobacco scientists anymore when we do cigarette stories. I don't think that we should be talking to climate deniers about climate stories. That is journalistically irresponsible.
Mark, did you know I'm one of the 97% you're talking about? Because that 97% statistic included people who believe that some portion of climate change is man-made. And I do believe some portion of it is.
You think it's a very small portion, sir. Do you deny that you stand in opposition to the overwhelming scientific consensus on this? If so, you need to read more scientific papers, sir.
I got a feeling I've read more than you have, Mark.
Well, I suspect you have, but I think I've interviewed a lot more scientists than you have, sir. And it is,
I think based on your job, I know which kind of scientist you interview because your job depends on
you interviewing
the kind on one side of the story.
See, this is the conspiracy thinking that you must retreat to in order to say in the year 2013 that climate change is not man-made, happening now and causing great suffering in the Philippines. Great suffering. And we have not dealt with this for 20 years because of this kind of nonsense, talking about how there's no human fingerprints on this. That is not what 97% of the scientists on this planet say.
And
Pierce, I repeat, journalistically, this is malpractice to have on somebody pretending that this is 50% and 50% when nobody in the scientific community takes the view that climate change is not related to
it's an interesting debate.
It's an interesting debate, Piers Morgan. That was wild. And we've come so far from that. At least they pretend like they kind of believe you now. How has that been for you in your professional life to be dismissed by know-nothings like this guy from Berkeley?
Oh, well, yeah, we got used to it early on. You know, those of us that are in the minority on this issue, we got used to it. So, you know, you got to be able to take the slings and arrows if you're going to play in this game.
Yeah. Did you think it was going to be a game when you got into it?
I knew it was going to be contentious. And it's become more contentious over time. Because originally, you know, this United Nations panel was much more measured, you know, that they weren't really sure how much of the warming was due to humans and all of that. But then every time they met every several years, the report would become more and more alarmist. And of course it was not because the scientists thought there was more reason for alarm. The whole process was guided by politicians from various countries, mainly the United States and Europe, who were really keen to turn this into a big deal, right? Because, you know, the bigger the problem you can create in the eyes of like the U.S. Congress, the more money you get to do research and the more power government has through, you know, controlling U.S. research interests. You know, I didn't remember any of the details of that interview with Piers Morgan, except the end, which you didn't have.
Oh,
which
sad.
Was where at the end, this Mark was talking down to Piers Morgan, saying, "You aren't doing your journalism right by having him on." And it pissed off Piers Morgan. And Piers pushed back, you know, and it sort of defended me, kind of like, you know, I'll be the judge of,
yeah,
of who I have on my show.
So they, these reporters who were, you know, sort of playing along, echoing whatever they were told about climate change / global warming / catastrophes / presumed to tell another reporter how to do his job, and furthermore to shame you, to attempt to censor you on live television. And they are shameless. They are absolutely shameless. And to bring up the 97% so-called consensus of scientists, which, as I recall, was a big, big joke. Tell me about that. People still remember that.
The study that came up with this, you know, infamous 97% statistic, it wasn't that 97% of all of the climate scientists agreed that global warming is dangerous and we had to do something about it. That's not what it was about at all. They basically went through all of the climate research papers, and I say they, it was, you know, some sort of climate activist students that they hired to do this. They probably didn't even understand what they were reading, but they were looking for evidence from the abstract, you know, a little summary at the top of a scientific paper of summarizes what's in the paper. And they were looking for any evidence that these papers disagreed with the idea that humans can cause climate change. Well, virtually nothing gets published that says, you know, we've shown that humans don't have an influence on climate. Well, everything has an influence on climate. You know, trees have an influence on climate, you know, but trees are somehow allowed to, but humans aren't allowed to, you know, it doesn't make sense. So it was really innocuous. And when I first saw that paper, that's the 97% paper, and I looked at what the things they were looking for, I thought, well, I'm part of the 97%, as I said in that interview. You know, I'm one of them. And I contacted the author of that study, and I said, why did you include, you know, you realize I'm one of the 97%. And he said, well, we don't consider you to be.
So they get to decide who's in the club.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
So is the Earth on fire? And what is this climate catastrophe they keep telling us? And how much does man play a role?
Okay, so our best estimate from a variety of measurements is that the Earth has warmed, okay? over the last, let's say, 50 to 100 years, but especially in the last 50 years. So, you know, there is, it seems like more than coincidence that it could be tied to increasing carbon dioxide emissions, which, you know, have also been going up the most in the last 50 years. Okay. The question is how much? How much has the temperature gone up? Generally speaking, the temperature has gone up less, depending on where you're talking about, okay? If we're talking about a global average temperature, the temperatures have gone up, you know, maybe 60% of what the climate models say it should be doing, okay? If you look at some key areas like the United States Corn Belt, the 12-state Corn Belt in the Midwest of the United States, in the summertime, which is key. I mean, you know, the U.S. helps feed the world through the Corn Belt. You know, it's not just corn, soybeans too. The warming there has been almost non-existent. It's been less, it's been slight over the last 50 years, let's say, in the U.S. Corn Belt. The warming has been almost non-existent and less than 30-some, all of the climate models, there's 30-some climate models, less than all of the climate models say it should have warmed by now. So this is the thing. The thing is, the policies, the energy policies that they're going for depend on these climate models being true. That's their what is guiding the policymakers are these computerized climate models. And they, in sometimes, are spectacularly wrong, you know, in terms of how much warming. And that's the kind of message we're trying to get out there, that, hey, these policies are based on models that we know warm too much. They produce too big of effects compared to what we've seen in the past. All right?
So I can remember, gosh, I think it was Anthony Watts years ago, got behind an effort to have people report where all of these thermostats or, you know, the temperature machines were, or whatever we officially call them, that tell us what global temperatures are like, or at least ones in the United States. Go out, check it out, take pictures, and see where they are. And we found them on airport tarmacs and right behind air conditioning outdrafts and vents and you know, all kinds of crazy stuff, which would, of course, increase the temperatures that they were reporting back to whomever was keeping track of them. NOAA. So what have you found out about that? To what extent does this play a role in so-called global warming, if in fact we have a lot of warming and we're going to go to hell in a handbasket?
Yeah, we've got a paper on this urban, this is called the urban heat island effect. We've got a paper conditionally accepted where we have done the first quantification of what the average urban heat island effect is as a function of population density. I mean, virtually every one of these thousands of thermometer locations in the United States has had population increases around it in the last 50 to 100 years, let's say, or more, which makes sense. I mean, population keeps going up, right? And along with population comes infrastructure, buildings, asphalt, cement, roofs, air conditioning vents, all kinds of things that produce spurious warming. So there's been this debate for quite a few years of how much of the warming we're seeing on land anyway, because this is only a land issue, the urban heat island effect. How much of the warming have we seen is due to just this urban heat island effect? And we're quantifying that for the United States. And we're finding, it depends on what period of time you're looking at. If you're looking at, say, the last 100 years, close to 50% of the warming is actually just due to population increases. But if you look
at,
like,
it's man-made, but not the way we think.
But in the last 50 years, it turns out, at least from our calculations, that a fairly small part, you know, maybe 20% of the warming. But these numbers matter. I mean, as it is, the warming we've seen, even if you believe the thermometers, is less than what the climate models say it should have been. But if we then reduce the observed warming because of that urban heat island effect, which is very local, you know, it doesn't affect global temperatures. Urbanization only affects a tiny portion of the planet. Then it becomes even less of a problem. You know, this is why I get into trouble with both sides on this, you know, because There are climate skeptics who think, it's all a hoax, blah, 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 blah. And I say, no, it's not. You know, there's some valid science behind global warming theory. And then, you know, the alarmists who say, oh, he thinks that it's, you know, it's trivial. Well, you know, that's why I'm a lukewarmer, right? More than once, Rush Limbaugh yelled at me, you know, Roy, it's a hoax. Don't you understand?
Well, you were the official global warming expert for the Rush Limbaugh show, which is where I first heard about you, actually. And then we ended up following each other on Facebook, and I approached you, and you said yes, and I couldn't believe it. Well, let's just sort of sidebar that for a second, and let's talk about Rush Limbaugh. To what extent did you know him, and tell me about your relationship?
Well, I called into his show at the end of a show, maybe 11 or 12 years before he died. And he liked what I was saying, and he asked me to come in the next day and expound on what I was saying. And he instantly, you know, sort of glommed onto me, you know, as his climate guy, right? And from then on, it was, you know, I corresponded with him sometimes several times a day, and very often, more often than not, it didn't have anything to do with climate. You know, I'm sort of an amateur economist, and I'm interested in a lot of things, and whenever he would talk about science things, he looked to me to provide an insight. The guy was amazing. He was absolutely amazing. I mean, I'd ask him, where did his memory, he's got amazing, he had an amazing memory. And in fact, one time I said, I don't know what to tell you on this, Rush. And he quoted something I told him a year before, showing that he remembered what I said a year before, and I didn't remember it.
Uh-huh.
And have you ever? I say, where does that memory come from? He says, it's the booze. and, you know, he invited my family and I over to his oceanfront house in Palm Beach, and got to meet his relatives from Missouri. It was a surreal experience. It took 2 or 3 years before I stopped being starstruck by the fact that he wanted my opinion on a wide variety of things.
Huh. Well, you know, I've noticed that people who, you know, number crunchers, economists, and people who like economic things and models and that sort of thing, they can tell you a lot about what's going on. Like, we got a lot of our most beneficial COVID information from people who crunch numbers, economists who crunch numbers and that sort of thing. So I never dispute that. I never deride that. It's an important study. And how did you get into this business? And
So my training is, my doctorate is in meteorology, because back in the late 70s, there wasn't really any need for climatologists, you know. The few people that went into that, all they did was, you know, look at average weather. It's like, who cares about average weather? You know, there were a few of them. But when I came along, is the start of the global warming research programs, and that's where the money was. So basically, it was the money. Follow the money. Now, what I was doing with meteorology is I was using satellite data. So I gave a talk at NASA Goddard in Greenbelt, Maryland, and there was somebody there from NASA Marshall Space Flight Center here in Huntsville, Alabama, a manager who said, how would you like to come work in Alabama? And, you know, for a 50% raise. And it was on shuttle stuff to begin with. So I've worked on a shuttle program, space station program. And then Dr. John Christie came there to work, who was more into the climate stuff. I was more into the weather stuff. He was more into the climate stuff. And at a meeting we had somewhere in, I don't know, Vermont or something, James Hansen had just given testimony for Al Gore, when Al Gore was head of a science and technology committee in the Senate, whatever the name was back then. And everyone was talking about it, right? Because that's what really propelled global warming into the public consciousness, was James Hansen coming out and saying that he knew that in that summer, 1988, which was a warm summer, he was mostly certain that some portion of that warming was somehow due, sort of, to increasing CO2. It had like four layers of caveats in there. But it hit the news. And then we were discussing over lunch, isn't there some way we can do this from space? Because, you know, the thermometers are only scattered very sparsely around the world. And I said, well, yeah, we've got instruments up there that provide input globally, temperature input globally for weather forecast models. And it goes, you know, basically goes into your daily weather forecast, these satellite measurements of temperature, atmospheric temperature. And so we decided, okay, let's get all of that data. Well, this is back before big data existed. In order to get data, any amount of global data, and we needed all of it, you know, like 10, starting with 10 years of it, 10 years of global data from all of these satellites. And it was going to cost, you know, millions of dollars, which we didn't have. So believe it or not, we we complained to Al Gore.
Gotcha.
Al Gore got a hold of NOAA, which holds on to all the satellite data. And the next thing we know, we get a phone call from NOAA saying, you know, I think we can just go ahead and send you all of that data. For the next 6 months, I was getting boxes of these big old 9-track magnetic tapes, which don't hold that much data, and loading them into my little tiny Honda Civic and carting them, you know, to our computer center to have them all loaded up. And it just took forever. It took forever to load all that data up. But we ended up, you know, compiling all of that data. And that was, in a way, our project started the government's push to make sure that all the data that's collected by meteorological satellites, environmental satellites, should be made easily available to the public. They sort of used our work as a case study of that we need to have access. Scientists need to have access to all of that data.
Is it still available right now? Does NOAA still provide everybody with the data?
Oh yeah. Yeah. In fact, we continue to download these satellite measurements. I mean, the instruments have improved over time, so we have to take into account that the instruments are better now than they used to be and all of that. And so we download the data, you know, we got automated processes where we're downloading the data continuously, and it's all free, and anybody can do that. You know, you got to have the computer resources, but yeah, it's there for anybody.
So you had availability that was available to you. James Hansen, of course, had this available to him. He came out and said in 2008 to reiterate what he'd been saying previously, we're toast if we don't get on a very different path. This is the last chance, meaning for the world. So that's where he went. You went somewhere else. You said, oh, hold on a minute now. Just a minute. Slow your roll, buddy. We're not burning up. We're not freezing. And so what happened with that relationship? You guys were working in different areas of NASA.
Well, we never worked together. I think maybe I've only met him once face to face. Maybe if you're asking, why did we go in different directions? This comes down to what we think in terms of the climate system, in terms of its sensitivity to increasing CO2. This is sort of the holy grail of climate research, is if you change some portion of how the climate system works, how will the climate system react? Well, in this case, we're adding CO2 to the atmosphere, okay? And we know that that keeps the global atmosphere from cooling quite as efficiently to outer space as it used to before we added the CO2. Now, I say we know, it's mostly theoretical, but the theory is pretty strong. And it's about a 1% effect now. The amount of CO2 we've added to the atmosphere has reduced the global climate system's ability to lose energy, to shed energy to outer space by about 1%. It's kind of like a pot of water on the stove. You know, if you got a pot of water on the stove on a low flame, and it's got a lid on it, okay, it'll end up having a certain temperature after a certain amount of time, because the amount of energy it gets from the flame equals the rate at which it's losing energy to its surroundings, you know, the heating up the air and all of that in the kitchen. But what happens if you take the lid off? It'll actually be cooler. Or if you put the lid back on, it'll actually be warmer. So temperature is always for anything. Doesn't matter, car engine, the human body, the climate system, the temperature of anything is a function of how fast energy is going in versus how fast energy is going out. When those two things balance, you don't have any temperature change at all. We've added CO2 to the atmosphere. We've upset the balance by about 1%, theoretically. That's if you believe the theory. And it should cause some warming. The question is, how much warming? So I'm getting, don't worry, I'm getting back to James Hansen and where he and I differ. James Hansen, to figure out how much a change in CO2 will affect temperatures, what he does, he goes back to what he thinks he knows about the ice ages from the ice cores, mostly in Antarctica, okay, where we see these on time scales of thousands of years, temperatures went up and down, CO2 went up and down. Well, I don't think we really have a clue about how all that worked, cause and effect, to use that as a proxy for what's happening today. But when he does that, he says, well, according to all that, you know, we're going to have a lot of warming. And I said, well, what about, I talked to him about this. I said, but what about the fact that the temperature changed before the CO2 in the ice record? Well, yeah, but maybe that he says that the temperature changed, like the temperature went up, then the CO2 went up, but then that had a feedback effect that caused the temperature to go up anymore. So it was all of this hand waving. So if you go through this hand waving argument that he does, using the ice ages, he comes up with a big effect of how much warming there will be. Now, we published a paper several months ago where we looked at not, you know, not what we think we know about the ice ages tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, I should say, hundreds of thousands of years ago, which I don't think we do. We use the best measurements we have in the last 50 years, which includes these buoys that are floating, thousands of them. They're floating randomly around the global oceans. They dive down as far as 2,000 meters and make temperature measurements continuously. And then, you know, transmit those to satellites. And all of that data shows that the oceans indeed are warming by hundredths of a degree. Hundredths, if you understood that. You know, a tiny amount. The oceans have warmed. And we published a paper here a few months ago where we asked the question, okay, let's look at how much the oceans have warmed from these deep ocean buoys, the land surface, the ocean surface, the surface temperatures of the ocean. And given the uncertainties in all of those, how much does that say we should have for future warming as CO2 continues to increase? And we got a number down at the bottom end of what the United Nations said is most likely. You know, they're talking about 1.5 degrees C to 4.5 degrees C for a doubling of atmospheric CO2. It's a factor of three. That tells you something right there, that the models can't agree within a factor of three of how much warming there's going to be, right? I mean, doesn't that tell you something about how good the models are? And this is after 30 years and billions of dollars spent. 30 years ago, they differed by a factor of three. They still differ by a factor of three. How can we say that the models are based on basic science when they disagree with each other? So anyway, so we get something closer to the 1.5 degrees, and that's if we assume all warming is due to CO2. If we assume all of the warming is due to CO2, what happens if half the warming is due to CO2? Well, then we can expect even less warming in the future as CO2 goes up. So that's why I'm a lukewarmer, you know, because our science says that it's not a big problem. But then, you know, that's why we don't get government grants anymore.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
a professor from Oxford University did a treatment. I'm sure you've seen this video on YouTube about how you've changed your mind on the models versus what you're doing now and the numbers that conflict. Have you changed your mind about what causes global warming over time?
I think early on, there was so much uncertainty. I entertained the possibility that you know, it could be all natural. I mean, this is back early on, and I just thought we didn't know enough. So it depended on what mood I was in and on any given day. I mean, because, you know, if you don't have much data, you got lots of room for imagining different things, right? So depending on my mood, I could either believe, you know, it's all natural or it's partly natural and partly man-made. But as time has gone on, I would say that my belief that a good portion, at least 50% of the warming, is probably due to the increasing CO2. But even if it's 100%, it's not a big deal. It isn't a big deal. It's not going to produce. Well, for one thing, it hasn't changed, as far as we can tell. It hasn't affected any kinds of severe weather, okay? Tornadoes, hurricanes, possibly an increase in rainfall. As the climate system warms, you get more evaporation from the surface. All of the water that's evaporated from the Earth's surface has to come back down as rainfall, okay? Eventually, I mean, in a matter of days. That's the atmospheric hydrologic cycle: evaporation, rainfall, evaporation, rainfall, and that should increase with warming. So if anything, you know, maybe more rain. Other than that, there just hasn't been any noticeable changes in weather that can be tied to human caused climate change.
Well, here you are discussing major weather events and their connection to global warming, because of course the default position for all TV weatherman and women is to push the panic button and immediately read verbatim the crazy prognostications from the people who believe that we're burning up and we're going to go to hell in a handbasket and somebody is going to get blown away by the global warming induced major weather event. Here you are. I think this is the Heartland Institute speech, and you encapsulate it very well. Let's listen.
For the Earth, we don't know the energy flows in and out of the climate system to the accuracy needed to know whether the climate system is naturally in energy balance. So what the climate modelers do is they program the models with the assumption that there's a balance. In other words, the assumption of no natural climate change. Then they add CO2, and the model warms, and they say, increase, we prove CO2 causes warming. Well, duh, it's what you assumed to begin with, okay? All right, early indications, they're now doing CMIP 6 climate models. What I showed you was everything was from CMIP 5 climate model runs. Earlier indications are that the CMIP 6 models have even more warming than the CMIP 5 models. I don't know why. They're just ignoring the observations. And finally, what I started out with, there is no climate crisis, there is no climate emergency. Even if all of the warming we've seen in any observational data set is due to increasing CO2, which I don't believe it is, it's probably too small for any person to feel in their lifetime. And I'll leave it at that.
Have you changed? You say now, of course, that you believe that there's a certain percentage of climate or warming from based on anthropologic.
Well, I would say that I basically agree with everything that I said at that Heartland conference. And that was, a few years ago.
Yeah.
At least a few years ago.
Well, you know, isn't it a testament to you that you actually have somewhat moved your position just a little bit because of data, as opposed to people who ardently believe these fantastical, catastrophic prognostications based on emotion? I mean, which I think a lot of it is.
One of the things I learned when I became a scientist is, well, first of all, I learned I should have been an engineer because I thought science had answers and it doesn't. Engineering has answers. Science doesn't. But anyway, one of the other things I learned when I became a scientist is it's not good to become ideologically or philosophically attached to any certain outcome from your data because, you know, chances are when you look at things more closely, when you look at the data more closely or get some new data, you're going to change your position. And I finally decided, you know, I'm not going to become emotionally tied to any outcome. I just, you know, go where the data shows. And it's a lot easier on your conscience and your mental health, I think, to be like.
In the end, you have to live with yourself. In the end, all you have is your integrity. And in the end, you have your science that you present to people and say, here's what I've discovered. And that's pretty much all you can do, I think, at this point.
Although there's not much of that going on. Everyone has, you know, decided what they believe in, and they're trying to find all the evidence to support that. I'm more like trying to balance, what's the phrase? I'm trying to provide some equal time in a sense that all we hear is gloom and doom. Okay. Especially through the media, right? The media only wants, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. You know, they only want to hear the most dire things. Things that most of the scientists that are part of the IPCC process wouldn't say on TV. These are things that are, you know, extreme scenarios that come out of the science that could happen, probably not. And then environmental think tanks pick up on it. And then they write reports on it. And then that's picked up by the media. And they pick the most juicy bits out of it. And then say, you know, they come on the news and say, scientists are now claiming blah, 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 blah. And it's by the time the public digests it, it's so blown out of proportion. It's ridiculous. And this is something that Dick Lindzen, you know, one of our top people in this field, he emphasizes this all the time. You know, what the public is hearing is not what's in the IPCC report. And that is supposedly the basis for all of the policy that changes that are coming. It's all been exaggerated. And so the public gets, you know, gets freaked out, right? And demands action. We've been lied to, basically. We've been lied to.
And to what end do you think that is? Just power?
Well, for the media, you, like I said, if it bleeds, it leads. For politicians, they've got, you know, they've got other agendas having to do with power and money and budgets. And then, you know, you can probably point to all kinds of things, whether it's COVID or whatever, where for some reason the government has decided that they need to be the ultimate authority on certain issues that depend on the science and get their, you know, they got all the money. They got all the freaking money.
We've seen the same thing play out with the COVID response as well. I mean, it's just been another, it just looks like the same playbook, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I think it is sort of the same playbook. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate.
It's not science, is it?
No. But then, yeah, like I was saying, when it comes to climate science, nobody's going to fund climate science just for science's sake. You know, the money we get for this comes through, at least in the U.S., comes through Congress. And as I always remind people, Congress doesn't fund stuff like this unless there's a problem, a potential problem that needs to be studied. The bigger the potential problem, the more money you can get. So now people, you know, we've got this marching army of climate scientists whose careers now depend on that continuing flow of money. So I don't see any end to it. I just don't. Before Rush died, he told me he thought we were losing this battle. You know, on air, he was always very upbeat. And of course, he would never give up the fight because the fight was important to not give up. But yeah, he wasn't hopeful that we would ever win this battle.
I will say that the nation's law schools are now churning out the specialty of environmental science and environmental law. So not only do they have this new cadre of meteorologists and behind them actual scientists and behind them, and I'm not saying that you're not an actual scientist. What I'm saying is, you know, the TV weather guys I'm talking about, the guys who actually are on the front lines spouting a lot of this stuff. And then you've got this cadre of people in academia parroting this stuff. And then you've got the lawyers who go, well, if somebody comes after you, I'm going to go get them. And we have to, you know, the world is, or as Katie Porter's daughter told her, the sun is, what is it, burning, and we're all going to die soon. And so that's their game. That's their message. And it's not true. I mean, it's just simply not true because, I mean, and I'm no, obviously no scientist, but I do know one thing, and that's, this is, I know a game when I see one being played on me. That's what's going on. And so I think to myself, well, you know, you talk about the fact that it's just not as impactful on the environment as we are told it is. And when you think about the entire delicate balance of the entire universe and where we fit in that delicate balance on this planet, you can't tell me that it's only one or two or three variables that dictate what happens to the planet. I don't buy that. It doesn't make sense. Simple algebra will tell you you need to have more variables than that.
Yeah, well, the fact that these climate models, after 30 years and billions of dollars of research into modeling the climate system, still disagree with each other on future warming by a factor of three. And that hasn't changed in 30 years. In fact, it's actually a little bigger disagreement now than we've ever seen before. So that tells you they don't have all the variables. And, you know, I could go into what I think they're missing, but that's too much in the weeds for this show.
Okay.
Well, you got a feeling a lot of what I've already said is too much in the weeds.
Well,
that's usually the complaints
I
get.
Dumb,
sir, I can't follow what you're getting. Can you make it simpler?
Well, yeah, I want it simple. I want to be able to convey the idea to the people I'm having an argument with, or a disagreement with, or, you know, a conversation with. I want it to make sense. And I don't think, you know, I'm not sure how successful the skeptics have been on that score. So, yeah. It's frustrating to me. Here you are talking about, now we're going to go back to the major events, or weather events, and how you say that, you know what, this isn't global warming related. It isn't climate catastrophe related. Let's watch this particular one.
Well, it has gotten warmer, as you said. Since the 1950s, there has been a warming trend. But what we haven't seen in terms of any long-term weather measurements is whether there's been any change in severe weather. There hasn't been any increase in hurricanes. That's on a global basis. In the United States, the frequency of hits of the United States by major hurricanes has gone down by 50% since the 1930s and 1940s. There's been no increase in droughts, no increase in floods. Tornadoes are down. But still, weather varies a lot, especially hurricanes, year to year, decade to decade. So there's a huge amount of variability, okay? Some of them stall, produce a bunch of rain. Certainly North Carolina is going to have a major flooding disaster. But this is what Mother Nature does naturally. And if there's a human influence in there, you wouldn't know it because there's so much natural variability.
So that's been a few years ago because Tucker Carlson.
Who was that guy, and why did he look like Newt Gingrich?
You do not. But yeah, so it's your belief that it's not all bad. Warming to the extent that we are warming, it's just not all
right,
bad.
That's another good point is, you know, we hear about how there's sort of been this assumption in this whole debate that nature is best left untouched. And that's, you know, that's not a scientific point of view. That's a philosophical point of view. And I've read an ecologist say that, you know, ecosystems, you know, are, you can talk about delicate balance, but it doesn't mean anything. Ecosystems are what they are, you know, and the CO2 we put in the atmosphere, we now know has caused global greening. Is that a bad thing? This is not a climate skeptic talking point. This has been, you know, published by scientists who have analyzed satellite data that look at color, you know, the global greenness. And they said since all these studies show since the 1980s, there has been global greening almost everywhere. And they're pretty sure it's due to increasing CO2. a study has been done into, because there's been a lot of research work done on how plants, mainly crops that are grown for whatever, you know, fruit trees, corn, how these things respond to increasing CO2. And it's been calculated that the increase in CO2 that we have produced from burning fossil fuels has increased global agricultural productivity by trillions of dollars. No one ever hears about this.
Okay.
It's not part of the narrative. You know, it doesn't help the narrative to be talking about the positive benefits of increasing CO2, but they exist. And there are scientists out there that know this, but you won't see it on the news.
Yeah, if you go against the grain, you might end up like Mark Stein being sued by Michael Mann for impugning his hockey stick diagram. And can you talk a little bit about the danger that you might be in as a result of this litigiousness by Michael Mann?
I don't know. We've been pretty lucky. John Christie and I are the ones that, you know, developed the original technique for monitoring global temperatures from satellites. And we've been doing this for over 30 years. And we've had relatively little pushback. I mean, you know, I get some letters in the mail that, you know, you can't die soon enough. You know, right. Go away, mm-hmm. kind of stuff.
Well, if you believe then, them, you're going to die anyway, right? Everybody's going to die because the climate's going to blow up. Yeah.
A few years ago, after the local Earth Day celebration, around midnight the following night, somebody came by and shot up our building. And, you know, we have a 4-story building with a lot of offices, and it was clear they were targeting John Christie's office. Because they hit his office and his secretary's office next door. Of course, nobody was there at midnight. So that's the closest we've come to any danger. And then the mainstream media just don't interview us anymore. You know, if I get an interview request, it's usually from Fox News.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that I suppose that is because they don't want to get sued. I mean, news agencies might get sued for defamation, like Mark Stein did by Michael Mann.
Well, I hadn't thought of that.
Right?
I don't worry about this stuff. I'm too busy buried in analyzing data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just worry about that because it's a censorship thing. It's like a slap lawsuit is what it is, basically what he did, and he's able to
do
it.
Yeah, well, forgive me for saying it, but I think Michael Mann has too thin of skin to be in this business. You know, we've been accused of a lot of things, and you know, you just have to let it roll off your back.
Mm-hmm. Are the polar ice caps melting?
There's been a downward trend in Arctic sea ice since we started measuring from satellites. In the 1970s. What that means, we don't know. I think it's a very poor piece of evidence to point to support global warming. The Arctic region, the energy balance, you know how I said that the energy balance of a pot of water, you know, depends on how much heat it's getting from the stove, how fast it's losing heat. Well, the Arctic is kind of special because it doesn't have much of its own energy. It depends on energy transport from the tropics and mid-latitudes up into the Arctic. If you change that energy transport, you can drastically change temperatures in the Arctic. And I think it's entirely possible that what we're seeing in the Arctic is just part of a long-term sort of seesaw cycle in Arctic temperatures. There, you know, there's a glacier, the Mendenhall Glacier in Alaska. Is receding, okay? You know, it used to push out into the ocean, and now it's receding away from the shore, and it's uncovering huge tree stumps that have been carbon dated to 1 to 2,000 years ago. Okay, 1 to 2,000 years ago, there was a forest growing there, and then a glacier came in, and now it's receding. Well, obviously, there's natural cycles in that, and yet these receding glaciers are pointed to as some evidence of human-caused climate change. You know, it's just everything we see in nature now. If there's a change, it's got to be due to global warming. Got to be due to global warming. People are ignoring the fact that the system changes all by itself. It doesn't, I've pointed this out over and over and over. It's a nonlinear dynamical system. It's chaotic. It can change all by itself with no changes in the sun or anything else. It's because the processes that are at work in the atmosphere and the ocean are complex, nonlinear, and they have all kinds of time scales, you know, from days to millennia. And the system can go through changes all by itself for no apparent reason. That is totally ignored now in climate research. It is ignored.
That's malpractice.
Well, I ain't a lawyer.
That's pretty bad. I mean, because it does, obviously does a disservice to the people who are the recipients of the information from the news media, and they get that information from unreliable sources.
Well, most of these scientists, I think, have a world view that the Earth is fragile. And so from talking to them over the years, over the decades, I really get the impression that they're on a mission from God, okay, to save the world. Yet it gives purpose to their lives to be working on something where they can tell themselves that what they're pushing for is going to be better for humanity, when in fact, they're probably going to kill way more people than they're going to save.
Right. Because that it will, whatever we do to mitigate the supposed terrible global warming, such as it is, will impact the people in poorest countries because they won't be able to use the.
Yeah, all the solutions are too expensive. They're too expensive. You know, the U.S. can sort of afford some of this expensive stuff. You know, Elon Musk's Teslas. You know, we can sort of absorb that, but poor countries can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess finally, it's these people have a religious fervor. They have an adherence to these kinds of crazy prognostications, much like the way the old Christian date setters. And I remember in the 1970s, oh, Jesus is coming back X. Jesus is going to come back here. And we have the same kind of date setting. We're going to go, the world's going to end in 30 years. The world's going to end in 12 years. The world's going to end in 7 years. The world's going to end. This is the last 50 days we have an opportunity to save our planet. If you don't spend this money and sign this treaty, it's just BS in so many ways. And yet here we are, decade three of the hubris. Even I remember reading Roger Revelle's comments about Al Gore and Al Gore. He had Al Gore in one of his classes at UCSD. And Roger Revelle is the first person who introduced Al Gore to the idea of global warming. And Al Gore took off. And Al Gore's not a scientist. He's no more a scientist than I am. And he's better at this than I am, clearly. But the Roger Revelle disavowed what he had commented on in class. He disavowed that. And Al Gore just kept on and, oh, you're not my professor anymore, and I don't believe you. I like this. Because he could go on and make a religious a church out of it.
Yeah, I've been told by Washington insiders more than once that they're convinced Al Gore really doesn't believe this stuff in his heart. He took up a position, you know, to make a career out of it. And of course, I don't know what's in Al Gore's heart. It's just interesting that there are some people out there that know him and think that he's just an opportunist on this issue.
Well, I mean, how many private jets does he have? How many waterfront properties does he own? Obviously, he doesn't buy what he's selling. And he'd stop flying private tomorrow if he really believed this stuff, but he doesn't. And the same, you know, Paul Ryan one time said, you know, the reason I have reached this pinnacle as a House Speaker at that point in time for a short live period was because I became an expert on something. I was told to become good at something. And so my thing was the tax system. I was besotted with the tax system. And he got to know it. And he got to come up with some ideas about how he wanted to change it. And he accomplished those things. And then he got the hell out. And that's the same thing, I think, what happened with Al Gore. He became good at talking about some particular thing. And people believe him. And they believe he's owns it in his heart. And it's imprinted on his soul. But doesn't sound like it. That's a shame. Listen, you've been very generous with your time, Dr. Roy Spencer. I appreciate you coming on, talking to somebody like me, you know.
What do you mean?
Person. Well, I'm not
You make it fun. You make it fun.
Oh, I hope so. You are wonderful. What's the last thing you want us to, you want to tell us that maybe I haven't asked about? Which
We don't need to go into a new thing. Just, you know, there is no climate crisis. Don't believe what you read in the news, you know, see on the news.
Thanks for coming on the Adult in the Room podcast.
Thanks for having me, Victoria.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Adult in the Room podcast. To keep the programs you like to listen to, please rate this podcast with a fantastic 5 stars on your Apple Podcast app. Every time you listen, and give me a great review. Plus, of course, subscribe to the podcast. It makes a difference with the big tech algorithm and the big tech oligarchs, and it makes us easier to find. Please get in touch with me on all the big tech stuff. Yeah, we're still there. Using the names Victoria Taft or the Adult in the Room podcast on MeWe, Parler, Minds, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks to 1ACast for imaging, editing, and production. The fantastic song is Gospel by the March 4th Band of Portland, Oregon. Music for Antifa versus Mike Strickland is Ride or Die by Raps by RC. The Adult in the Room podcast is also a production of Flamingo Road Studios. Remember, head up, heart out, and strive to be the adult in the room. Till next time, mischief managed.